amazing.
Yeah, just nuts. And it's kind of fun for me because I've started a bidding war between a couple of television stations. So,
hey,
we'll see what comes of that.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're totally out of the know, just basically writing columns that they
I just write my columns and email them in, and they print them and send me a check.
Yeah, that's great.
I've not been to the new offices and have no interest in in going there.
Yeah, it's just fascinating. Also, just seeing the personnel and stuff. I just talked to Dennis Terrio at the Portland Mercury, mm-hmm. who's going to start working in Salem for the Up.
Oh.
So. It's like, geez.
Well, they desperately needed to strengthen that. I mean, it was down to Jeff and Ian Culligan, who's very young.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah. And Christian didn't last, so there you go. Yeah.
I wonder what's happening with Christian now that
Yeah. I mean, the last I heard, he's been a good flag. So. Like when something would break in Willamette Week that I would be in, he'd call me later and say, my employers want me to do this, and then we'd talk afterwards. So, yeah, that kind of stuff. So, the Atiyah biography, all this is archival quality, and will eventually go into our archives. And when Vic asked me to write, it turns out his vision and my vision were the same, which is why I said yes. And so it's not just about him, and you said you had limited knowledge of him, and that's great. Mm-hmm. But it's also about the times.
Okay.
So it's you know, the 70s, but especially the 1980s, you know, segueing into the 1990s. What was the time like, economics, politics, you know, the whole shebang? So that's where your brain comes in.
Okay.
For, you know, a nice perspective, putting things in. Although, you know, I have to say, as good social scientists, we have to look there and say, in light of the governor resigning tomorrow and a new governor, we may have interesting frames as we look at this just today.
Yeah.
So tell me what you know about Vic. Were you here when he was governor, or did you come right after?
Okay, I arrived here in 1977
okay.
to teach at Reed.
Right.
And I went into journalism in 1980. At Oregon Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
I was there for 2 years, and then I went back east for a year to New Jersey, and then I came back to be on the editorial board of the Oregonian in October of 83.
Okay. So that's why your articles appear in the Rajneeshee book.
Right.
Right. Just so you know, I'm this close from getting the key people in the Rajneeshee stuff from inside the administration to tell me all. So, just...
Oh, excellent.
Oh, finally getting that side out would be just
yes,
great.
Story that really should be told.
Yeah, yeah. So, what do you remember about Atiyah as governor?
Well, let me start with the first part when he was running for governor.
Okay. Yeah.
In 1978, and you know this was a very remarkable thing. It seemed to me there were three candidates in 1978.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was Tom McCall trying to do a comeback, and there was Atiyah, and there was Roger Martin, who was the Republican House leader from Lake Oswego.
Mm-hmm.
And what was remarkable about this was that Atiyah was considered the conservative candidate,
mm-hmm.
you know, the alternative to the whole Hatfield-McCall moderate Republican ascendancy.
Yeah.
And it's always struck me that thinking back to that, 10 years later, Atiyah was the face of the moderate group wing of the party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the party had just sort of completely changed around him at that time. And you know, it was also impressive that he defeated McCall.
Mm-hmm.
McCall was already at legendary status. at this point. You know, he'd been out for 4 years after being governor for 8 years, and he was also in very bad health, and this was pretty clear at the time, and you couldn't talk to him without this being evident.
Mm-hmm.
And also, what we would have thought of as the moderate vote was somewhat divided by Roger Martin, but still, it was an achievement for him to get the nomination. And then he defeated Straub in what was a very good Republican year.
Mm-hmm.
But he also came out of this situation, which is almost unimaginable now. I mean, he was head of the Republicans in the Senate, at times when they were wildly outnumbered.
There were six or seven.
Right. It was 23-7.
Yes.
And in a situation like that, you didn't really have party line votes.
Right.
There was no point in Republicans holding to a party line situation. So everybody worked together, and if you look at the arrangements of the Senate when Attia was there, it was really a way that was unimaginable today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were Democratic state senators, conservative Democratic state senators from Grants Pass and Klamath Falls and Pendleton.
Mm-hmm.
No, there was Republican state senators who would be considered pretty liberal.
Mm-hmm.
L.B. Day, a Teamsters leader
from
Salem, who was a Republican state senator.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't have any of this today, but at the time, it was a really nonpartisan operation because of the variations between the two parties and also the overwhelming advantage that the Democrats had.
Mm-hmm.
So he really came out of that situation. So although he was a Republican governor and working with a Democratic legislature, it was a way people could still work together. And when you got to the massive economic downturn in the 1980s, when suddenly the timber industry just collapsed, and what had seemed to be an endless Oregon rise in prosperity and population throughout the 1970s, suddenly came to just a screeching halt and reversal. There were ways for everybody to work together.
So do you see that as a function of more of the times or more of the extreme minority the Republicans had in the Senate?
No, it was really the times.
Uh-huh.
Because, first of all, at the time, Oregon politics was completely dominated by moderate Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Hatfield and Packwood, Dave Frohnmeyer, Norma Paulus, various people who were state treasurer at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And these were folks who were accustomed to working with Democrats, who weren't that distant from Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And they found ways to work across that would be very difficult to imagine today.
Yeah.
And Democrats had this huge majority in the state Senate, a much smaller majority in the state House, but it was not difficult for them to work with the Republicans who dominated the executive branch. And he fit into that, although he was among the more conservative Republicans at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that changed. I mean, two things changed. The first was the structure of the Oregon Republican Party.
Right.
Because you got to a point in beginning in the 80s, but really coming into fruition in the 90s, where these folks could no longer win Republican primaries.
Right. Yeah.
So there was a change in the Republican Party, but you know, there was also a change in the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of Democrats representing, you know, the places I talked about, you know, Klamath Falls and Pendleton and Grants Pass, became impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it seems to me there was always an analogy between the way Democrats were sort of cleared out of the South on the race issue,
mm-hmm.
and the way Democrats were cleared out of rural Oregon on the environmental issue.
Yeah. So you see, the environmental issue is the key. Did the Reagan ascendancy play a role in that, or was this? Did you see more of a local environmental angle, resource angle?
I think it was mostly the resource angle.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the timber industry collapsed,
mm-hmm.
and people in rural Oregon saw Democratic tree huggers from Portland as being a part of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And thus it became very difficult for Democrats to contend.
Yeah. Yeah.
In much of the state.
It's interesting, as I'm talking to people, people still conflate the spotted owl with the beginning of the 80s and the recession. The spotted owl didn't come along until
right.
the mid-80s.
Right.
So that's going to be something I'm going to really peg down and point out, you know, how memories work and things. But it's just fascinating.
Yeah, well, the timber collapse, you know, was pre spotted owl.
Yeah.
It was the early 80s, and
yeah.
You know, it had a lot to do with 14-15% interest rates,
yeah.
and pretty much the demise of the housing industry, and sort of the market for timber collapsed.
Yeah.
You know, before the environmental issues came about, but there was still the beginning of a sense that
right.
these environmentalists had something to do with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So take me to Atiyah as a governor. You're going to the editorial board 83, so the economy has already fallen apart.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to figure out what to do. Eventually, he decides that what we need to do is go to every country in the world and recruit business and things like that. But so, talk about him as governor in this time.
There are two things, though, that were striking about it.
Mm-hmm.
The first was the financial response to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea is, yes, I mean, everybody cut things a great deal and, you know, whacked away at all the various parts of the state government. But then it got to a point where he and the legislative leadership, you know, concluded as a bipartisan basis that you really couldn't whack away anymore, and they agreed on an income tax surtax.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, a very difficult thing to imagine happening today.
Yeah.
Especially a difficult thing to imagine a Republican governor who had been elected as an explicitly conservative Republican governor just
mm-hmm.
agreeing to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But it happened, and you know, it happened, you know, relatively smoothly as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if you set what happened in the early 1980s against what happened in the early 2000s with the five consecutive
right.
Special sessions, which didn't really end up amounting to much.
Right.
You know, you see the difference between a system where people were expected to make things somehow work out, in a system where people were expected to nail down their collars on one side and just hold on to them.
Yeah.
So this was really a significant achievement on his part. And you know, then you got to the other aspect of it, you know, to his belief that you know, his role as governor was to become economic salesman for Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And this was not uncontroversial. I mean, clearly nobody was against going around and telling people that Oregon was a good place and a place to make money and you should be willing to come there.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you got to the major you know, controversy of his second term, the unitary tax.
Yeah.
Where Oregon altered its tax system to collect, and the way it was going to collect money from corporations that were not based here. And, you know, this was clearly a non-negotiable demand on the part of the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want to say it was quite a gun to the head situation, but it was clearly a yes-no situation.
Right.
And he did it.
Yeah.
I remember there was an Omen cartoon at the time. Mm-hmm. Of you know, Dick Atiyah signing the repeal of the unitary tax on the deck of a battleship.
That's great. Yeah, yeah, that's great. Yeah, I just last week was talking to Jerry Thompson, the chief of staff, and what she says is exactly what you observed. They had one particular meeting, I can't remember which company, NEC or something,
mm-hmm.
but they were coming back in the official car and they weren't saying anything. But the next morning they got up and they called each other and said, we just have to repeal the unitary tax. I mean, that's just the way around it. And there had been other companies that had said it, but it was very clear they had reached that point. Just had to go.
And it was a political decision, but you know, it was also symbolic of the change in the Oregon economy and the change in the American economy.
Mm-hmm.
That you know, we were going to be from then on a place where foreign manufacturers came in and assembled things and did business, which was you know, clearly a reversal of the immediate post-war World War II situation where Americans sent things out to be assembled in other countries.
Yeah, yeah. So big shift. Talking about the unitary tax, there are some who say that the trade-off with the budget wasn't worth it. In effect, I wrote the piece for the Oregon Encyclopedia Project,
mm-hmm.
and very interesting how long that takes to go through.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the anonymous comments was about that. Basically, he said schools took a big hit because of it. And I looked cursorily as going through, and I couldn't find any evidence of that, and so I didn't even deal with it in that article. But it's something that I come up, you know, people still remember that. I'm going to talk to Earl Blumenauer later. He has that sense as well. Did you get a sense of that the unitary tax was not a great trade-off? It might have been initially or, you know, anything like that?
Well, I can't claim to be, you know, economically or mathematically expert on
mm-hmm.
that. But we had a great desperation at that point for jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that this was going to produce jobs. I mean, it was a national recession. You know, Oregon's unemployment rate was above the national unemployment rate.
Yeah.
And you know, the question is, people either were or weren't going to come in and open factories and provide jobs and employ Oregonians. And you know, this was a much more immediate and pressing
uh-huh.
situation.
So jobs, you know, number one.
Jobs
yeah.
were number one.
Yeah.
And you know, also, you know, it wasn't like there was a real alternative here. That you know, if we didn't repeal the unitary tax, these companies were going to come in, set up operations, and pay taxes at the previous
right.
level.
Yeah.
there was clearly, you know, a beginning at this point of a major shift in the taxing situation, a reduction of the proportion of taxes that were paid by corporations, an increase in the proportion of taxes that were paid by individuals. You know, to the point now where our revenues are almost entirely individual income taxes. But, you know, at the time, it seemed we were in a situation so desperate to try to find some employment that, you know, we made the deal. And, you know, there was a sort of political taking away at ATEA because of this, but, you know, I don't think there was a major wave of opposition.
Okay, that's great. Anything, you know, other things that you remember? I mean, you were at Oregon Magazine, and then you come back and they're still going. So Rajneeshis, for instance. The impression, especially reading the Oregon Magazine-based book, is, and it's very explicit in there, you know, nobody in the government was doing anything. So what was it like at the time? What were your perceptions about what was going on and how that was playing out? Vic Atiyah himself, and this is how I'm going to pry information out of some of the sources inside, Vic said he could have handled the Rajneeshis and he could have handled the recession, but handling both was really, really, really hard. And so that those kind of bookends is going to say, you know, the Rajneeshis are really important, we need to talk. So tell me about the Rajneeshis and perceptions about what the state was doing, Vic's role, that kind of thing.
You know, I don't remember him having a very active role in this. The person who comes to mind is Norma Paulus.
Right.
You know, who was running the elections and that just had so much to do with the Rajneeshi attempt to take over Antelope and later to try to take over Wasco County.
Yeah.
And her role and her prominence in that. And it was a very strange situation with the Rajneeshis because the lethal malevolent aspects of it were not immediately apparent. And, you know, it looked like there was this strange group which seemed considerably offbeat, but generally cheerful and not dangerous.
Yeah.
And they were coming into an area, putting a lot of money into it, which again was a considerable interest of Oregon in the early mid 80s, and it was interesting that this was happening. You know, this was remarkably small town, and there were like a voting population of 12 people.
Yeah, it was very small.
And you know the. There was this one or two room school which had a dozen kids, and suddenly there were hundreds and thousands of these well-educated, affluent people streaming in from all over the country, all over the world. And there was a while where people thought that the Antelope folks were just small-minded, small-town, NIMBY people.
Yeah.
And I did a piece for Oregon Magazine in the summer of '82, and we spoke to a lot of them, and they were interesting people who were encountering something they had never imagined. And then after that, of course, everything got much more poisonous and dangerous. We discovered all these things later on about what they were doing.
Yeah.
But I really don't remember it being a prime concern of his. It was mostly a matter of Norma Paulus making sure the process worked the way it was supposed to work.
Right.
You know, I mean, he was certainly not sending in large numbers of state troopers or the National Guard to try to maintain order in the vicinity. And I think he was quite willing to leave that to her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. Vic then, I mean, let's leave aside the Rajneeshis. Vic is Trader Vic, going on all these trips.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the image of that? I mean, Trader Vic was a pejorative at the beginning. It became, you know, something he ended up being proud of. Mm-hmm. This is his whole business after he left the office. So talk about Trader Vic heading off to, you know, especially East Asia, but goes to the Middle East, you know, all those things. So what was that like?
Well, for East Asia, I mean, there was a sense that, you know, we really needed some kind of different economic future.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going off in search of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was the first governor really to do this, but you can see all kinds of governors since then have gone off on these regular trade missions.
Yeah.
And then it was Japan, and then it became South Korea, and now it's China.
Mm-hmm.
So he really did sort of set this pattern, which extended and broadened afterwards.
Yeah.
And the Middle East was something different,
mm-hmm.
because this was a very striking thing, that this was the first American governor of Middle Eastern origins,
mm-hmm.
and you know, there he was going back there,
mm-hmm.
and you know, nobody thought that we were going to have, you know, a strong, you know, booming jobs producing trade relationship with Syria and Lebanon,
mm-hmm.
but there was clearly an impressive historic presence to his going there. And you know, it had more to do with building those kinds of ties, and I think for him also it was a very personal thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I talked to Mike Donahue, who was one of the journalists who went on that first trip, and you know, there's the entire group of Oregon business people.
Mm-hmm.
And in Saudi Arabia, Mike was talking to a wheat farmer, and the wheat farmer was saying, you know, had good yields, but then Mike said, well, what happens if the yields drop? He said, oh, don't worry, there's oil under the entire. Like, so you have alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
And none of those alternatives wouldn't involve Oregon in any way, shape, or form. So Middle East is a different ball of wax.
Yeah, it's good.
I'm discovering all sorts of interesting briefings and debriefings with the CIA and National Security Council and that kind of stuff. So he's in effect an unofficial ambassador of the Reagan administration, which is just fascinating to look at. Other things during his governorship that stand out? He, for instance, had weekly press availabilities, had open houses. Did any of that, you know, hit your radar? Or?
Well, he come into the editorial board,
mm-hmm.
Frequently.
Uh-huh.
And you know, it was a very casual atmosphere when he did, and you know, and it was really a very casual atmosphere at the time. I mean, people on the editorial board were people who'd been writing about this for a long time and had known him for a long time. And I remember when he and Hatfield and Packwood would come in, you know, it would be Vic and Mark and Bob, which struck me as a little unusual, and it's I've sort of been careful not to do, but you know, these were people who had been, you know, operating at these levels of Oregon for a long time,
mm-hmm.
and you know, also, you know, he was a fairly enthusiastic smoker, and you know, this was at a time when you could actually still smoke in the Oregonian building.
Yeah.
And I think it was Herbert Tarrytons.
Oh yeah.
And this would just be constant.
Yeah.
And he came in, and you know, he was clear. He was direct. He was talking about this, and you know, there was a dramatic difference between you know, his visits and say the. You know, his successor as governor, which was Goldschmidt, because mm-hmm. I mean, you would ask Goldschmidt a question, and you know, he would sort of roll out this rapid fire 5-minute intensely wonky answer to it, and it was nothing like that with Atiyah. Atiyah mm-hmm. would just give you a very relatively brief, straightforward answer to these things, but you know, he certainly knew how. State government operated,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I think about the 1982 re-election,
right?
And you know, here was this situation where the state was in a very bad economic situation. There was a national recession, a national democratic trend.
Mm-hmm.
And there was Ted Kulongoski, who had surprised everybody by getting them, you know, 44-45% against Bob Packard in 1980. So mm-hmm. they sent him out again against Atiyah in 82,
mm-hmm.
and he just got swamped.
Yeah,
you know, he lost by about as much as you know, anyone had you know, lost the governor's race in Oregon.
It took Bill Sizemore to beat the record.
Right. And if you consider that, I mean, not only was that a historic victory,
mm-hmm.
but it was the last time a Republican won a governor's race in Oregon.
Yeah.
I mean, you could see what a personal triumph this was for Atiyah.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, he could do this in the midst of this economic problem, but people really had a sense that he was doing what he could do, and he was dealing with the problem not in a partisan manner, but in the practical and in a most and the most hopeful manner that you could look for.
Mm-hmm. That brings up the concept of political capital, something that John Kitzhaber clearly ran out of a week and a half ago. Did you ever see Atiyah or talk to people kind of out in the hustings who were saying, wow, you know, he's our governor, he's the guy? I mean, did people respond to him like that? You know, Tom McCall was popular.
Right.
I mean, people, when Tom McCall came from a town, people remembered it. It's like they put up plaques.
Mm-hmm.
Atiyah went through probably more of those towns, but, you know, did you sense the enthusiasm or... He's one of us, you know. What did you sense?
Well, he did go through all of those towns,
mm-hmm.
and you know, he was a presence in those places,
mm-hmm.
and you know, again, you know, Omen, who had an incredible eye for these things, would always draw him wearing this pin.
Mm-hmm.
And the pin was the state of Oregon with a very small diamond where Baker was. And he had been given this pin,
mm-hmm.
you know, appearing in Baker for its you know, centennial or sesquicentennial or whatever. And he would always wear it. And it was sort of a reflection of his connection out to all of the different places. In the state, and you know, there was a sense again that this was a reasonable person making reasonable decisions.
Mm-hmm.
He was very fond of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was certainly never, you know, in any sense an electric figure.
right.
a galvanizing figure the way McCall was.
Yeah.
And I remember once, you know, a member of the editorial board went up to Vancouver for an appearance by the last Republican governor of Washington, Spillman.
Yeah, I think Spillman.
And he came back after watching Spillman and said, boy, when Spillman meets with Atiyah, the flies must just fall off the walls.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was never a kind of electric sense, but a deeply, you know, respected sense,
right.
and the idea that a Republican governor and Democratic legislative leaders were working together to try to make sense out of a very desperate situation.
Yeah. The Baker pin is great because Atiyah is governor exactly when I don't live in Oregon. And I never think I'm going to live in Oregon ever again.
Mm-hmm.
But that gives wonderful resonance for when Goldschmidt comes in and disses Baker.
Calls Ben. When
he made
the middle of nowhere.
Was that about Ben? Okay. I thought it was about Baker.
There was a question where he was going to debate and why he wasn't debating in Ben, and he said there was no point in debating in the middle of nowhere and the government.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Clearly not Skier either.
Yeah.
Anything else about his governorship jumps out? I mean, you paint a picture of a nice, competent guy.
Mm-hmm. So this is really in the time before the Republican Party changes dramatically. You know, the very beginning of how this is happening, and he is, I say, you know, more conservative than the basic model, but still he gets on with it,
mm-hmm.
and. There are a lot of things which, you know, become crucial subsequently. You know,
mm-hmm.
such as supportive schools and nature of the higher education system,
right.
and how criminal justice is going to operate, which really didn't seem, dramatic at the time and immediately pressing at the time. I mean, we were trying to get through an economic collapse.
Yeah.
But he steered Oregon through this collapse, but it did sort of leave an opening for Goldschmidt in 1986 to say, we need a more dynamic approach to reshaping the Oregon economy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yes, Atiyah was Trader Vic, and yes, Atiyah worked with the legislature and did some things that would now seem very difficult, but. The idea that we were going to have an activist, assertive, dynamic
mm-hmm.
figure in the governor to really try to bring the state back to where it was,
mm-hmm.
did seem to be a contrast to the way Atiyah had run the office.
Yeah. Did you see Norma Paulus as having problems showing that dynamism?
Very much so.
Uh-huh.
No, because she ran a very laid-back campaign on the insistence that, well, she really knew state government.
Right.
And she, in terms of this, the state budget and state finances, she knew where the bodies were buried.
Right.
And she came into the editorial board for her endorsement interview, and we'd say, so where are some of these bodies? And she would just sort of nod knowing. So, you know, she didn't give you the sense that she was someone who was going to come into office and really grab hold and drive things. I mean, she sort of took the idea that she was going to be a very knowing and well-informed manager of the operation. And, you know, there really was a sense at that point that we were, you know, looking for something a little more dynamic and assertive than what we'd had.
Yeah. Do you see that pattern as continuing, you know, in subsequent elections after that? You know, you have Dave Frommeyer, Barbara Roberts, Kitzhaber, Smith. I mean, do you see that dynamic as continuing, or do you see it as we kind of go, we want the manager sometimes, we want the dynamic person?
Well, there's two things. The first is, you know, we have been economically just sort of rocketing back and forth between extremes since then. So, you know, sometimes you're looking for a manager, but you know things can change so sharply in this short period. And I remember, Kulongoski, as he was leaving office, and you know it was in the middle of this historic post 2008 economic collapse.
Yeah.
And you know he remembered coming to office in 2002 when we were still struggling out of the post 9/11 collapse, and he went to this educational session for new governors at Harvard at the Kennedy School, and they told them, well, you folks are very fortunate because you're dealing with your recession at the very beginning of your term. You know, and the idea that by the end of his term he was going to face a recession vastly bigger than the one that was in effect when he came into office. So there's been that part. The idea that immediate economic conditions have always been so pressing since then.
Yeah.
And there's also been, you know, this extreme rise of partisanship since then. So, you know, you look at the way Atiyo works with a Democratic legislature in the beginning of the 1980s, and you look at the way Kitzhaber works with a Republican legislature in the end of the 1990s, and it's a different world.
Yeah. And Atiyo vetoed a lot of stuff, but so there's still a sense that he's working with them.
Yeah, I mean, he vetoes a lot of stuff, but it's in the process of finding a way to make it work.
Right.
Whereas, you look at the stretch where Kitzhaber achieves a historic number of vetoes and becomes known as Dr. No.
Yeah.
And the idea is, I mean, this is not in pursuit of getting us somewhere. This is just in pursuit of preventing bad stuff from happening.
Yeah. So both sides have changed in their
Both sides have changed. And, you know, also, Measure 5 changes everything.
Yeah. And during Vic's time, he was there, while he was governor, there were three or four Measure 5-ish votes, and he was just terrified of every single one of them. And was able to push it off and push it off.
And then, you know, it's, I think it, during his time as governor, that he and the Democratic legislature adopt the kicker as a way to try to ward off, you know, the tax limitation measures, and you know, we sort of ended up with the worst of both worlds, Measure 5 and the kicker.
Yeah, that's one of the very first questions I asked him, because in public he has offended the kicker. And he said, you know, I thought it was a bad idea. It was Deb Spott's thing. And, but it had so much support that I signed it. And so that's something I'm going to really look into, you know, the dynamics of how that worked.
Well,
so,
I mean, first of all, as I said, people were, supporting this as an idea because they thought it was going to ward off tax limitation measures.
Yeah, Prop 13.
And, you know, exactly.
Yeah.
1978, the same year Atiyah is elected governor, California adopts Proposition Measure 13.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
this is sort of the beginning of the whole tax revolt, and this is spreading into Oregon, of course. You know, it's got these hugely unforeseen implications.
Right.
So, you know, when Atiyah is governor, I mean, nobody thinks the schools are going to closed down,
right.
The schools are going to be hacked at dramatically, but, you know, on the other hand, when he's governor, you know, there are large stretches of Oregon which are spending half as much per student as Portland is, and people figured that was just the way it was.
Yeah, exactly. Put him in perspective, we already did that a little bit, but put him in perspective, for instance, by the time he died, people were looking, and I was one of them, I haven't done the research to see if it's true, the decisions made under his watch created the Silicon Forest, you know, brought Oregon into the 21st century economy, that kind of thing. You get a sense of that, looking at that? I mean, I'm specifically asking him about it. It's interesting because, you know, Hewlett Packard was here before,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing. And he saw the key dynamic is the fact that Tektronix is here. It was really the catalyst that made it possible to talk to those companies
mm-hmm.
and get things going. So what's your sense of that perspective?
Well, Tektronix and Hewlett Packard were here. You know, they were growing,
mm-hmm.
And I guess Intel was in the early stages of,
mm-hmm.
of coming up. But, you know, it really seemed that the increased Japanese presence changed things.
Mm-hmm.
Made us more of a world player.
Okay, yeah.
But the other thing was that we never had, you know, the kind of investment, you know, especially in higher education, that would turn us into a Silicon Valley. I mean, we were never going to be a Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
But we were also pretty much going to be an assembly operation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the big money, the R&D money, was going to be spent elsewhere.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, we were way, way behind. You know, we were never going to catch up with Stanford or,
right.
or places like that. But You know, we could have been more of a player, and that kind of thinking never really fit into Atiyah's economic plan.
Yeah.
I mean, the strategy was to get people to come in and invest,
yeah.
not to try to have a kind of higher education
right.
infrastructure that would lead to a bunch of spin-offs and grow a new generation of Tektronics.
Yeah, yeah.
And eventually this began to happen a little, but it was more because of the economic attractiveness of Oregon as compared to trying to get yourself started in Silicon Valley than because we were actually having the intellectual educational firepower to drive it.
Right. It's interesting, during the recession, the only two things that weren't cut and that were increased were economic development and higher ed, which surprised me because my impression of higher ed is exactly what you described. We've been doing it since the 1920s and teens. I mean, it's been a long, long period of time. And so what I'm going to really investigate and see, so what was that investment supposed to do and what happened? You know, even if it increased, for instance, Japanese language slots, that would be a big thing. But so what did it actually do? Or in the recession, was increase simply not cutting?
Well, I think that was really, really the case. That if you could just sort of support things as they were, it was considered a triumph.
Mm-hmm.
But we were historically way beyond California and Washington in terms of higher education, in
yeah.
terms of what we were producing, and that really didn't change much.
Yeah.
I mean, but there was always this sense in Oregon that if you wanted higher education, fine, but this was a place where you could make a living wage coming out of high school, and you wanted more, that was sort of up to you.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that sort of collapsed during Atiyah's administration,
mm-hmm.
and it would have been difficult to come up with the money to sort of counter program to
yeah.
it, but it was clear that it was going to be necessary, that we were going to need to be a more of an information technological economy to survive and it's taken us a long time to get to that point.
Yeah.
But we passed the lottery, I believe, in 84.
Yeah, which Atiyah opposed all the way through.
Right. Everybody opposed it. The Oregonian opposed it too. But one of the things that's striking about this, aside from the idea that it was free money,
mm-hmm.
was that in Oregon, the lottery proceeds were connected to economic development. Now, there were other states where lottery proceeds were connected to education, were connected to elderly services.
Mm-hmm.
No, here, because of the situation we were in, economic development was the magic word.
Mm-hmm.
And if you said it was going to drive that, the arguments against it almost collapsed.
Yeah. Talking to Atiyah's chief of staff, once that thing passed, he was a tiger to make sure that no money went for anything except economic development.
Yeah,
because as we've seen,
but then
the call on that money expands over time.
Well, it does, and you then get this decision from the Attorney General, which essentially says that, you know, anything could be considered economic development, and that's how you know, all of the money sort of, or most of the money gets grabbed away to try to backfill the schools.
Right. Right.
Crisis.
Yeah. So, any other things about ATIA?
Well, is this sense about how the Republican Party just sort of you know, turned around him? That, you know, he went from being the voice of the conservative wing of the Republican Party to being the voice of the moderate establishment wing, and.
So do you see him as changing, or
no, he
actually stayed
the same?
He
doesn't change, you know.
So it is a truth.
It's like he's here and the party's here, and then he's here and the party's here. But, you know, I remember there was a Dorchester conference, I think, in the, you know, early 2000s, maybe, where you have all of the leaders of the Republican Party who had been getting clobbered in elections, you know, and they were going to get together and assemble a Republican candidate who could actually win, and they all gather around this chair, and sort of a surgeon's and barber's operation, and things are being pulled and things are being attached. And then when they all withdraw to show their successful achievement, sitting in the chair is Vicatia. And no, that wouldn't have been the sense at the beginning of his career, but as he got to the end of it, that was what was there.
Yeah. I'm going to be talking to some of the Republicans that he worked with. The last one he spent a significant amount of time with was Chris Dudley. He also did with Rob Cornelis, but Rob Cornelis didn't. He just got steamrolled. And so talking to Dudley is going to be really interesting to see how that worked, you know, with modern campaign methods and all those other kinds of things. But, yeah.
Well, there's another example, which I talk about a lot, which is ATIA is the state senator from Raleigh Hills. You know, at a time when you know, Washington County is a country club Republican,
And dairy farms,
and dairy farms,
yeah.
And you know, it's the legislative delegation is heavily Republican, but, you know, it's sort of a moderate kind of Republican. And, you know, now the delegation from Washington County is almost entirely Democratic.
Yeah, only Republicans come in from other counties.
Right, and, you know, like only John Davis, you know.
Yeah,
sort of,
yeah.
Sticking in through there, and you know, in his own county, the party sort of turns around on him, and you know, they stop nominating people like Mary Alice Ford, and they start nominating people like Eileen Cueto.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah. You know, that,
which was very successful in the mid 90s, very successful, but short-term success.
Yeah.
Vic describes that time. For instance, there was a time in the early 90s he ran for and was elected as a National Republican Committeeman because the other person was a social conservative. And he didn't want to be a National Republican Committeeman, but he knew that we couldn't have that. But he talks about the frustration late 80s, early 90s of people coming into the Republican Party and then redefining what it means to be Republican. Because he talks about principles. And so they were, in fact, redefining what the principles were, and just frustrated the heck out of him. And that's what he saw. That's what he saw.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, I hope this has been...
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Useful.
Fantastic. Yeah. I'm talking to Hardy Myers on Thursday. He was the speaker during a heavy special session time.
Mm-hmm.
So, just lots of good fun stories.
Mm-hmm. Is Ed Bailey still around?
He has been cited...